Screen.
I'm going to make my announcements very quickly because I know how eager you are to hear Mrs. Doerr. We have two readings scheduled for next week. Wednesday night in the University Art Museum, six students will read. Lolly Butler, Ann Heed, Harry Kressler, Kim Kuykendall, Kevin Lanou, and Holly Welker. And on Friday afternoon, in Student Union 283, Navajo poet Lucy Tapahanso will read. That's at 4 o'clock, Student Union 283. 2 weeks from tonight, Writers at Work will present the first in their series of readings, and presenting the novelist, essayist, nonfiction writer Edward Abbey in this auditorium. Copies of Sonora Review, the university's literary magazine, are on sale tonight. And also, we have a few copies of Stones for Ibarra on sale. I hope you'll stay and have some punch and cookies and tell Harriet how wonderful she is. I mean, you already know, but you've got to tell her too, you know. Harriet Doerr comes to us from Pasadena. She went back to school after a long time away and finished her work at Stanford and stayed on as a Stegner Fellow in their fiction program and received a Hinfield Award for the writing that she was doing, which was later put together as the novel Stones for Ibarra, which she will read some of for us tonight, but she's also consented to read some newer work. It's been such a pleasure to have her with us, and I wish all of you could have heard her speak with classes yesterday. It's my great pleasure and privilege to introduce Harriet Doerr.
I won't be able to see the book if I'm back here. Is that all right?
It's very sensitive. You don't have to be real close to
it. Oh. Okay.
It's a new gooseneck, that's why
grandma. Okay. I have a clipping. It's a record. Oldest authoress. The oldest female author was Mrs. Alice Pollock of Haslemere, Surrey, England, whose book, Portrait of My Victorian Youth, was published when she was 102 years, 8 months. So, I like to start with this because it gives me hope and courage. You know, it makes you feel rather young. People do say, why wait so long? And it's absolutely true that being 32 is quite a lot better than being 77. And you have all that future in front of you. But the reason I waited so long was that I wasn't at all convinced I could do it, and I didn't try seriously till quite late on when I went back to school. I was not like Truman Capote, who said, I've known all my life I could toss a bunch of words up in the air and they'd come down just right. I didn't know that. And I wasn't like E.B. White either, who said this. Later on, not when he was a boy, and I think he was writing to his brother, yes, in 1947. I'm glad to report that even now, at this late day, a blank sheet of paper holds the greatest excitement there is for me. More promising than a silver cloud, prettier than a little red wagon. It holds all the hope there is, all fears. I can remember really quite distinctly looking a sheet of paper square in the eyes when I was 7 or 8 years old and thinking, this is where I belong. This is it. So how wonderful to know that and at the same time have the talent of E.B. White. Only a fool would read any word or four or five or two sentences of E.B. White before they were about to read themselves. That puts me in my place. And people say, is it ever too late to start? Well, I don't think it is. I think old age can be terribly tiresome, but I don't think there's any reason for it to be boring. I'm going to tell you about a friend of mine who retired from his business at the age of 65. And soon after that, a friend of his retired. So my friend gave his friend advice about how to spend retirement. And this was his advice. Never go to the bank and get a haircut the same day. So, I don't think that's absolutely necessary. I think that there must be something else. Seems to me that there's so little time from the moment we're born starts running out. Then they say, how is being published once changed my life? Well, it's changed my life utterly, and that's one reason I'm not getting on with the next thing I'm trying to write. Lots of things happen extremely unexpectedly. Well, you get telephone calls, you get visitors, and you get lots of interesting mail. The only thing I don't have is a glass of water.
It's underneath.
Oh, there it is. Thank you. I'll tell you about one or two letters. I had a wonderful letter from Sapopec, from someone I didn't know at all, quite soon after the book came out. This woman is an anthropologist, and she was studying the Huichol Indians there, and had lived there for years and years and years, and I suppose was going to live there forever because she loved it so much. And she said, please come and just stay with me whenever you want. I kept her letter, so maybe I can still go. And then I have a friend who's constantly making reservations for me in a hotel in Asuncion, Paraguay, for 3 months. And she writes me, says, dear Harriet, the manager has changed, but I think I will find you a room anyway. And it hasn't the hotel hadn't changed that month. I never said a word to her about going there. She thinks if I go to Asuncion, I don't know why, that there I will finish the book in 3 months in this place. And it's a constant correspondence about what's happening, what the view is now, and how the rooms are. Then probably my best letter came from someone in the federal penitentiary in Lompoc, California, who wrote a letter to say that he didn't have, he'd read reviews of the book in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal in the penitentiary. And he said he didn't have any money. And he was coming begging. So, of course, I sent him a book immediately. And in his letter, he said this is what moved me to do it. He said, being in jail isn't the worst thing in the world. Being broken in jail isn't the worst thing in the world. The worst thing in the world is being broke and in jail with nothing to read. So naturally, you couldn't wait to get the book in the post office. This is a question I was asked in class yesterday. Am I wiser now than before? No, of course not. Not wiser. More experienced, yes. Wiser, no. I think what people this age have is the long view. You remember everything. You remember Maude Adams, Houdini, Lindbergh, learning how to drive, and a Model T Ford. Another thing you remember is what war this day is commemorating. there was a quiz, maybe this was only in California schools, I don't know whether it was nationwide or not, and very, very few people knew the difference between World War I and World War II. Well, I think that's quite good of the students. That proves it's all for nothing. Nobody can remember the numbers. So from a writer's standpoint, in your old age, you have these things, perspective, experience, and unless you've somehow found out all the answers, you still have curiosity. And if things still make you wonder, you have imagination. And with all this, assuming you love words, you have a lot of what you need to write a story. I don't think age has terribly much to do with it. But as for wisdom, that's a completely different thing. It's like the story, probably apocryphal, about Gertrude Stein dying with Alice B. Toklas at her bedside, and Alice, wanting to get the final important word, said to Gertrude, "What is the answer?" And Gertrude Stein, with her last breath, said, "What is the question?" I'm sure you all know that. But that's absolutely, absolutely true, because the questions proliferate so. You think you have one sort of solved, and then 10 more come along, and that keeps you from being wise very effectively. And what made you do it? Well, I was encouraged by a teacher at Scripps College and by someone else at Stanford. And without that, I'm sure I would have been convinced I couldn't do it. You know, I didn't have that much faith in myself. And I think what it's all about is a matter of spying and eavesdropping and seeing and hearing. And you happen to see small things on the street corner, in the elevator, where you're eating, or as you drive along looking out the window of your car, and just for a second, those things strike you as being earth-shattering. They strike you as being terribly important. And everything, every single thing, including man's fate, seems to depend on your getting it down exactly right on the page. I think that's why you do it, probably. Now, I'm going, Lois said I was going to read out of the book. My intention was to read you a slightly newer story. I don't dare say new, but a newer story that was published in the New Yorker last year. And then if there's time left over, I was just going to read a short excerpt from the book of a page and a half, which is very important to me. But we can see how the time goes. This is called Picnic at Amapolis. A number of years ago, in the town of La Luz, on an August day, half of hot sun, half of rain, Don Enrique Ortiz prepared to sell his ancestral estate to an American gentleman and an American lady. "The economy of Mexico compels me," he explained, facing his two buyers across a desk littered with legal briefs. "Taxes," said Don Enrique. On the wall behind him, under his grandmother's portrait, hung a calendar dark with inked out days. "Taxes," he repeated, "they are becoming insupportable." The American gentleman, who was using the false name of Bud Loomis, nodded. Like other travelers, he had come to Mexico for the sake of new surroundings, to get away, particularly to get away. His own taxes were under investigation in Arizona. In his pocket was a summons to appear in the Phoenix court that day. "I know what you mean," Bud said in border Spanish. He drummed his blunt fingers on the arm of his chair and stared at Don Enrique's calendar. "So I'm selling the land that came to me through my mother, all 4 hectares of the land at Amapolis." As he spoke these words, Don Enrique Cesar Ortiz de Leon apologized silently to that Castilian ancestor of his who had stepped just behind Cortez onto Mexican soil. He drew his spare frame taller in order to stiffen his pride. "How much is an hectárea?" asked the woman in slow, precise Spanish. From her shoulder bag, she removed a pencil and a notepad, on which her name, Susanna Ames, was printed at the top. She pulled her chair closer to, and made space at a corner of Don Enrique's crowded desk. "Susanna Ames," Don Enrique pronounced phonetically to himself. "Her name is Susanna Ames." He repeated it like a soundless chant. In answer to her question, he said, "An hectárea is 10,000 square meters." Bud Loomis, who had reduced her name to one syllable on the day they met, said, "The whole thing's 10 acres, Sue, give or take." Then added without speaking, "This is going to be a steal." 10 acres, as much as that, she was clearly surprised. At this, an identical notion entered the minds of both men. They believed they were in the presence of a helpless female. This Susanna Ames, Don Enrique supposed, was in need of a man, perhaps one her own age, about 30, or better, an older man, one who understood business and the law. Bud retained his original impression of her. When he and Sue Ames had met for the first time by coincidence in the property agent's office, he noticed her looks and her reckless attitude toward land, concluded that all she needed was shaping up. Further acquaintance only reinforced his opinion. Now, with the two men observing her, Susanna Ames began to draw for the first time in years. She sketched on her notepad a long rise of ground, which dropped to a lake at one end and met the steep slope of a hill at the other. Beyond it, she drew in a whole landscape of cornfields, and beyond them a range of mountains that climbed to a peak. She lined one shore of the lake with a neat row of houses and a church. She left empty the flat, extended surface of the rise, though she might have penciled in a dream. For in a corner of her mind that excluded reason, she had already constructed a low adobe house and a separate studio looking north, and had planted 4 apricot trees, a small vineyard, and an alfalfa field simply for the green of it. Though this house did not appear on the page, Don Enrique noticed that she was exaggerating everything, the fields, the mountains, the good order of the dwellings that faced the pond. He had never seen so elegant a small church as the one that took rough shape on her page. He became concerned. "Have you visited the property?" Sue continued to draw. Now at the center of the rise, she was building a Stonehenge of tilting columns and broken pediments, all that was left of Don Enrique's centuries-old hacienda. Don Enrique persisted. "Were you there long enough to walk about?" "Is he crazy?" Buzz asked himself. "We've already told him we'd buy." Sue said, "We spent an afternoon there with the agent." Bud corrected her. "An hour and a half," he said, "just before dark." But even in that brief period, he had found time to walk about. Once satisfied in respect to connections for electricity and water, he had started pacing off the land. On that occasion, Sue Ames had gazed after his short, thick figure as it moved away, stepping out straight lines and corners in the distance. Pleased her to think that he was drawn as she was to the serene, empty place. Even so, it had taken her 10 days to reach a decision. Between calls to her lawyer and her bank, Sue considered alternatives. Each morning on a sunny bench in the plaza, in the principal plaza of La Luz. Each rainy evening on a stiff chair in her hotel room. Actually, the matter had been settled the day she chose La Luz as a stopping place, partly because of the sweep of landscape that surrounded it, and partly because no one she knew had recommended it. Neither her friends nor her family in California could be aware of this settlement, remote as it was from any airport and from both coasts. Sue, divorced 2 months ago, believed that in rural Mexico she might at last be let alone. People here would hardly expect her to live wisely, marry happily. A middle-sized town of no particular architectural or archaeological interest, La Luz rested quietly on the plain between a winery on the east and a railway line on the west. Trains bound north and south stopped at the red-plastered station twice a day to load and unload freight and a passenger or two. The Plaza of La Luz, shaded green by Indian laurels, faced on one side the entrance to the town's main hotel. This was the Posada del Sol, a hostelry of 30 rooms, cold and bare as cells. Sue took one of these, first for 3 nights, then a week, and eventually for a number of months. At first, her days were all alike. She sat each morning in the plaza, ate a lunch of thick soup and bread in the hotel, and spent her afternoons outside the town, driving wherever any road would take her. It may have been the intensity of light, or the transparency of air, or simply the illusion of unlimited space that brought her to a decision. On her third evening at the hotel, she spoke to the manager. "I believe I will remain in Mexico," she said, "perhaps in La Luz. Do you know of a house?" The manager was also the owner of the hotel, a man worn thin by lack of trade. He contemplated the American woman, one of his 14 registered guests. His examination revealed nothing, except that she appeared more determined than other women he had known, and richer. He gave her the name of the property agent, whose office was around the corner between a notion shop and a bakery. Following morning, Sue entered the agent's ground floor room, only to find someone else, a stranger, already there. "Another American client," said the agent. "Bud Loomis," said the man. Sue waited on a chair against the wall for Bud to transact his business. Time went by. It became clear to her that an impasse had been reached. Bud finally turned away from the agent's desk. "You go ahead," he told her. "I've got to do some figuring." Then, as though preordained, it all began to happen, step by step. Sue inquired about a house to rent, then about one to buy. She said, "But there must be something." A silence fell, and she rose to leave. Then Bud turned from the window. He said, "Wait a minute." Sue sat again and listened to him say, "There's a piece of land we could split up." Before the day was over, arrangements had been made to visit the property at Amapolis. The agent requested credentials, and Bud produced a deposit slip verifying a substantial cash balance in a local bank. Sue said she would have to call her lawyer in California and also her bank. She displayed documents, a passport, and a driver's license. But the agent had already noticed about her an air of absent-minded integrity, which by itself inspired trust. That was 10 days ago. Now in Don Enrique's office, the back of his high-ceilinged house, Sue went on drawing. She outlined a stand of pines behind the ruined walls. "I have something to suggest," interposed the lawyer, "that we visit the property together to avoid a misunderstanding. Please be my guests on Sunday. We will eat lunch in the fresh air." "No need to bother with all that," said Bud. We're ready to settle now." But Sue was accepting the invitation. "Then we will meet at Amapolis." Don Enrique examined his two buyers. Their indifference to each other puzzled him. "You're related, are you not?" he asked. "Brother and sister?" Though this seemed impossible, there was no resemblance. "Or cousins?" The impatient man across from him shook his head. The lovely Susana Ame shook hers. Don Enrique lifted a hand to warn her. A guileless woman entering into a costly negotiation with a stranger who was in a hurry. But in the end, addressing them both, he only said, "Do you have a car?" As if that, as well as the land, were something they would share. Each, however, had a car and nodded. "Next Sunday at 2, said Don Enrique. He turned to the calendar, circled the proposed date, and at the same time crossed out yesterday, which had slipped by unnoticed. On Sunday, the three cars converged almost simultaneously at the picnic place, having turned in close succession from the highway at a sign that said, "Amapolis del Lago, 1 kilometer. Don Enrique's ancient Buick sedan, packed with baskets and folding furniture, led the way along two ruts between thickets of weeds. Still in single file, they were almost in sight of the lake when a new sign, hand-lettered, appeared on their right. Lomas de Amapolis, it read, and indicated the way across a narrow ditch and up an abrupt slope. Bud was the first to jump out of his car, a Mustang so new it still lacked license plates. He walked over to a huizache tree in whose sparse shade Sue had parked her station wagon. It held a number of flat wooden boxes and an easel in the back. Looking in, Bud foresaw art that would never sell. He asked if she had noticed the new sign at the turnoff. Lomas de Amapolis. What a name for a place to live, he said. Poppy Heights. Sue directed her attention to Don Enrique, who stood next to his car, offering his arm to the oldest man she had ever seen. When this person was finally on his feet outside and drawn up to his full crooked stature, Don Enrique introduced him as Pepe Gomez, who had been born on this land and was the grandson of his own great-grandfather's major domo. Then Don Enrique introduced the Americans to Pepe. These are the people who are buying the property, informed the aged man, Senor Loomis and Senorita Susana Ames. Don Enrique went on to say that he and Pepe usually drove out here on Sundays. Though I never lived here, this was always my home. He pointed to the ruins, and Sue imagined that for him, the massive house rose up again each time he came, its roof and walls intact, its doors deep set, its carved cornices in place. The picnic party gathered in the shadow of an arch, and everyone helped Pepe set up the chairs and table, arrange the cloth, and extract five glasses from a basket. Into four of these, the old man, with remarkable agility, poured red wine. Don Enrique explained the fifth glass. The padre from the village often joins us. You may meet him. Bud looked at Sue and shook his head. She saw him think, another waste of time. Before seating his guest, Don Enrique proposed a toast. To the lives we have lived, he said. The others raised their glasses. And to the one ahead, he continued. And all drank to this immediate simplification of their futures. Then Don Enrique kicked away an anthill and some thorny stalks, drew out a chair for Sue at his right. Pepe, meanwhile, laid four plates and an earthenware dish on the table. Who made these good tacos? Sue asked, and found that Pepe's elderly daughter was in charge of Don Enrique's kitchen in La Luz. Bud swallowed a small green chile whole, choked, said Jesus, and reached for his wine glass. Don Enrique pondered his two guests. How can they afford it, he wondered. How pay for this exceptional land? Now that you see Amapolis again, you are disappointed, he declared in a statement directed mainly to Sue, though it was Bud who responded in English, hell no. I don't expect to change my mind, said Sue. But she had, in fact, noticed for the first time the depleted look of the earth on which her house would stand, the dangerous drop where the rise fell away at one end above the village and the lake. She had observed the rugged terrain, the absence of trees except for a scattering of scrub oaks. The surrounding hills were lower than she remembered, the cornfields fewer, the distant mountain peaks scaled down. That is a volcanic cone, said Don Enrique, following her gaze. What do you think of the lake? It's a little smaller than I remembered it, and it is larger now and deeper than it will be next spring during the dry season. Do poppies ever grow here, she asked. I think my mother said so. I've never seen them for myself. Then Pepe brought grapes and cheese, opened another bottle of wine, and Don Enrique, urged on by the old man's nods, began to an outline of family history. Sue leaned forward. At the first mention of a 16th century Spanish count, Bud pushed back from the table, upsetting his chair, and before long could be seen at some distance, stepping off great squares. On my father's side, Don Enrique went on, a governor, a conductor of the National Symphony, a rector of the university. On my mother's, a foreign minister and two bishops. The three still at the table sat a moment in silence, warmed by the splendor that radiated from the Artiste de Leon genealogies. Many of them born in the house that once stood here, Don Enrique waved toward the collapsed pillars, strewn rubble of his ancestors' former bastion and country seat. There were generals on both sides, he added, and recognized scholars. Sue sank without resistance into the past. And the house, she said, I suppose it was destroyed in the revolution. At this, Pepe gathered his waning reserves and rose joint by joint to describe the revolution of 1910, a good deal of which he remembered. But his teeth were so few, and the images he sought so reluctant to come, that of all he said, Sue understood only two words, burn and kill. Don Enrique, middle-aged and childless, listened as though for the first time, until at last Pepe stopped in mid-sentence and sat down. Sue glanced behind her at the scattered traces of the former house. So now there is nothing left. One bed, said Don Enrique, but he did not describe this bed, tall, posted, and canopied, cradle of illustrious infants, that had by some special grace survived, or mention it was there on a hair mattress that he himself now spent his lengthening nights. He turned his aquiline profile to Sue and looked into the distance where Bud was tramping back and forth across the land. What's he doing, the Senor Loomis, he asked. Is he disoriented? I'm not sure, she said. But it was precisely at this moment, with clouds darkening the day, the plates and glasses still to be packed, that Sue noticed a cold wind from the east and the sudden presence of a stone in her shoe, and finally understood that Bud meant to subdivide the land. Now Don Enrique was waving in the direction of the village and the lake. Sue watched as first the head, then the shoulders, then all of a black-robed priest came into sight at the edge of the mesa where a path led up the bluff. His ascent was so steady and inexorable that even after he was entirely in view, it seemed he might rise a few inches more and approach the picnic party with his feet not touching the ground. But he made his way toward them in an ordinary manner, his shoes crushing spiders and ants, his habit collecting nettles. As he approached, Sue saw that the priest was young, younger than she. Here is my friend Padre Miguel, said Don Enrique. And to the priest, may I present the Senorita Susana Ames. She is one of the new owners and plans to build a house on the spot where we stand. Oh no, Sue said, not here. At the far end, she pointed to the place where Padre Miguel had first been seen. The priest, who saw no difference between the north, south, and center of this strip of land, allowed his gaze to rest on Sue's face. Is this woman a Catholic, he wondered. But he doubted she was. Of the two or three priests Sue had met in her lifetime, Padre Miguel impressed her as the only one entirely suited to his calling. His eyes burned, and he appeared to have been fasting. And here comes Senor Loomis, Don Enrique might have been announcing the players on a soccer team. He will be joint owner of this land. Padre Miguel looked into Bud's square, coarse-grained face, believed he saw a troubled man. Two irresolute Americans, thought the priest. Bud acknowledged the introduction with a nod, pulled Sue to one side. I've got an idea, he said. She refused to listen, saying, let me tell you where I want my house, and indicating the bluff, beyond which peered the top of a bell tower, half a church dome, and the outer rim of the lake, which had faded to slate gray under the massing clouds. Don Enrique overheard, not too close to the edge, he warned her, there's danger of erosion. From that point, you will look straight down on the cemetery, said the priest, in a voice unexpectedly deep for a man his age. Bud took Sue's arm and propelled her toward the leaning portico of the old house. This is my idea, he said. And while he spoke of selling lots, Sue studied the volcanic cone, whose sheer sides were faintly green with terraced corn. Eventually, she heard him say, it's a deal made in heaven. He went on to speak of land as collateral, of cheap labor, of doubling or tripling their money, of a joint reserve in Mexican securities. These damn bonds pay 40%, said Bud. There's no way we can lose, no way. Sue, pinned against a crumbling pilaster, confronted her own common sense. It's not too late to get out of this. To say my funds are insufficient, my lawyer has strong objections. I'm homesick for the sea in Mendocino, California. Then neither of us will have the land, since it's being sold as a single piece and neither of us can pay for it all. May I still build my house over there? She pointed. Why not, said Bud. Sue turned in a slow circle. The hills, the fields, some stretches of pure desert revolved around her. Far away, a dog barked. A burro, carrying two boys, raised dust on the road to the village. A cow waded into the lake. And all at once, she surrendered her orchard, her vineyard, and half of her view. She said, all right, yes. As soon as they rejoined the others, Padre Miguel invited them to visit the village and the church. I've got to get back to the motel, said Bud. Next time, Padre, said Don Enrique, rain is coming, but have some wine. When they raised their glasses this time, they simply wished each other health. Pepe, not sure how old he was, drank with relish to this toast and to the years or perhaps the months he still had left to live. Soon light rain began to fall. The picnickers and the priest were about to separate when a figure came into sight at the top of the bluff. Skirt flapping, shawl dragging, a little girl ran toward them through the drizzle. What now, said Bud. He gathered up chairs and moved in the direction of the cars. The barefoot child crossed the stretch of land with astonishing speed. Once arrived, she quickly kissed the padre's ring, then went to Pepe and took his bony hand in hers. Sue felt a pang. She began to mourn the child's future in advance. There were never eyes so shadowed as these, never cheeks so scabbed, neck so stem-like, hair so clotted. When the girl lifted her head to smile at Pepe, she exposed baby and second teeth at odds, competing for space in her mouth. Don Enrique led her to Sue. This is Altagracia Gomez, he said, Pepe's great-granddaughter. After you are settled here, she will come to work for you. But she's only a child. She's 12. By the time your home is built, she will be 13. That's old enough. How do you know? Sue wanted to ask. Everyone is old enough for something, and too old or young for something else. A few weeks later, on another rainy afternoon, the contract was signed in Don Enrique's office under the portrait of his grandmother, a young woman almost too satin, jeweled, ribboned, and combed ever to have lived. The lawyer had failed to keep his calendar current. The last date checked off was the day before the picnic. While Don Enrique sorted documents, Bud smoked, crossed and uncrossed his legs. During the pause, Sue spoke. I can't believe our good fortune, she said. This must be the most beautiful piece of land in Mexico. She's a fool, thought Bud. Any more of this, and even now when we're almost under the wire, we'll drive up the price. It's a large property for two people, said Don Enrique. You will have a pair of ranches. At this, Bud, abandoning caution, disclosed his project. 20 fine lots, he told Don Enrique. I thought it was 10, said Sue. Her words were lost in Bud's recital of building plans, street lamps and paved walks, cesspools, and in time telephones. Don Enrique, foolishly neglecting to claim a share of the enterprise, seemed to welcome it anyway. My godson is an architect, he informed the Americans. He can help you. His wife may also be of use. She is a weaver, a designer of cloth. Now, each of the three people in the room separately saw a sample house. Its individual shape, its solid patio, its textured curtains and hand loom spreads. Simultaneously, it occurred to Don Enrique that the town of La Luz was growing too fast. That each day found it noisier and more crowded than the day before. Country air, he began to think, and only a 30-minute drive from Amapolis to his office. Why not? Thought Don Enrique. There was a knock at the door, and Bud started, as if even here a federal agent might track him down. But it was only Pepe, trembling under a silver tray, a bottle, and four glasses. Don Enrique held up his hand. He looked from one to the other of his clients. Are you Catholics, he asked, as though we were about to impose a condition of purchase. No, why, said Bud. I used to be an Episcopalian, said Sue. But Don Enrique had merely been remembering holy days in the village by the lake. He named a few of them, Corpus Christi, Guadalupe, San Juan, Asuncion. These are colorful festivals, he went on. Perhaps even as Protestants you might wish to see. Here he stopped. Oh, yes, said Sue. Bud had his eye on Pepe and in the quivering tray. My God, how old can you get, he wondered. Then it was done. The agreement signed, the tray set down, the brandy poured, the toast proposed and drunk. At this moment, an Amapolis del Lago, Alta Gracia Gomez, entered the church to kneel at the back, offer prayers for a necklace and high-heeled shoes. At the same time, Padre Miguel, on his knees at the altar, prayed to be assigned to another parish, a larger place, where he could be in the company of people who talked well, had talents, examined ideas. Then, for having asked this, he prayed to be forgiven. As soon as dark came, night animals began to occupy the 4 hectares of long, flat ground above the village. Each creature followed a purpose of its own, to eat, to mate, to dig a burrow, or simply run from north to south by moonlight. Heedless of approaching change, they traced the lengths of walls and paths to come. They paused in doorways not yet raised, circled trees not planted. Their footprints webbed the dust of unmarked building sites. 3 gophers, meeting on Sue Ames' plot of land, anticipated her rows of lettuce, beans, and corn, and began to tunnel underground. Slow workers in the dark, they would not find her roses until May. I probably should explain to you that the New Yorker took this story as a story, but actually it is a first chapter of a new book. So that explains all these people left, I hope, a little. These people left dangling there with many situations and problems ahead of them to be solved. Thank you. Is there time?
You have all the time.
So I just wanted to read a page and a half out of the stones. It's from a chapter called Immense Distances, Extraordinary Events, and this, I don't know if you've read it, but this woman goes back after her husband dies and has to sort out things, and so she starts going through cupboards, and every time she takes things out, she looks at them and puts them all back again, sometimes adding to them. So she has been going through things. That evening, Sarah sat at the sala window as long as she could see leaves drip and flower pots overflow. Then, instead of listening to another record in the dark, she went to the north bedroom little lamp and turned the brass wreath to open the comoda. She took out a shoebox together with a pile of letters and papers that lay on top of it, an accumulation she had gathered since her March arrival. Depositing it all on the nearest bed, she began to sort. She first picked up a fertilizing schedule she had made for Paco. This she set aside for Luis, although she knew his true persuasion lay in the circle of the seasons and the direction of the wind. She pulled out a black-bordered newspaper clipping. It was an announcement of Richard's death, placed in the Concepcion et Aldo by a committee of miners. With grief, said the clipping, in esteem. There were 3 prescriptions signed by the hematologist in California. Here a packet of seeds marked flocks. Behind a recipe for oyster stew, use fresh Blue Point oysters, she found a twice-doubled piece of pink paper. What's this? She said aloud. The residual dust of dry leaves lay in its folds. Sarah lifted one of the vein-scented skeletons, chamomile, she said, and knew it was from Lourdes, knew it was meant to ensure impossible things, long life, a forgiving nature, faith. There was too much here to sort in a single night. She began to refill the shoebox. When she found the accumulation was more than it could hold, she went to the closet for another box. She left the room in order, the doors of the coma that closed, the shelves full. But she had taken something with her, and later on in the kitchen, she spread it on the table. It was a road map so worn that the creases and the torn edges had been taped. On it, an automobile route through the southwest United States and central Mexico had been lined in red. Stopovers circled. One end of the road in San Francisco was Richard's specialist. At the other, the Malagueña mine. The mountains and deserts and plains that the map, without illustration, implied had been climbed and descended and traversed so often that Sarah, years later and 1,000 miles away, without needing to close her eyes, could see the village with the Ocotillo fences, the vine-covered boxcars switched onto sidings for family homes, the grazing land, the settlement without a well, the broken hacienda reflected in a lake. She could put her finger on the map and say, here's a blind curve, here's a grade crossing. This is where we saw the Tarahumara Indian running beside the road. She knew the distance in miles and kilometers between gas stations, between places to spend the night. All these motels, Sarah thought, were their rooms waiting to be brought to life with toothbrushes, the local paper, slippers beside the bed. There had been occurrences in these places that at the time seemed scarcely memorable. But from this distance, from the kitchen of the house in Ibarra, where she stood alone on a rainy night, they were exposed as remarkable. One morning in Durango, while the Evertons were eating breakfast in their hotel, a man rode a horse into the vestibule, dismounted, took out a knife, and chased their waiter from the dining room. Once in Chihuahua, Sarah heard music long before daybreak, pulled Richard awake and outside to listen to a mariachi band of 12 serenade a pair of shutters that remained latched and bolted from the beginning to the end of an hour's songs. She moved her finger on the map and remembered Assumption Day in Morelia. On that occasion, there had been no need for her to wake her husband. The rockets that seemed to explode under their pillows at midnight lifted them simultaneously from sleep onto a balcony. Between the detonations, shouts and cheers racked the night. It's like the end of a war, said Richard. Above the church, spotlight shone on a painted figure of the Virgin attached to an upright pole. In the midst of a succession of blasts, human screams, howls of dogs, police whistles, and a siren, bells began to toll for Mass. Tracing the marked route, Sarah recalled the motel where Richard killed a cockroach, the one where he crushed two scorpions. She folded the map. She foresaw that future sorting might prove difficult. So faint and uncertain was the line that separated the significant from the trivial. It occurred to her this evening in Ibarra, with rain at the window and Richard 4 months dead, that nothing ever happened on either numbered or unnumbered roads that could be classified as unimportant. All of it, observed by dark, observed by day, was extraordinary. Lois decided about questions.
It's okay.
Should we have questions or no questions? Should we have one or two? I better put on my long distance glasses now so I can see any hands that come. I'll try to repeat the question so people can know what it's all about. Yeah? Where? Oh, no hands, no questions. Oh, there's one.
Did this book come from? Mostly from your imagination, or is there some truth in it from your own life?
There are three things. Experience, observation, and imagination. Every single thing I think that goes through a writer's mind and gets on the page is some sort of combination of those three things. I think imagination is terribly important in that trio of things. So I would say it's all three. I'll say I couldn't have written it if I hadn't lived in Mexico. Does that answer your question? Yeah?
You said that you were going to read that particular page and a half because it was especially significant to you, and I would like to know why.
Because I believe it. I believe that every single thing in the world is extraordinary, that there's scarcely anything you could just walk by.
Right.
Occasionally. True, some things are a little bit boring, but you can find an extraordinary thing where you least expect it, and when put into perspective and against other things, then its importance and its extraordinariness increases, I think. I think everything is awfully interesting, almost always. Yeah, yeah. You have to listen a lot. That's what Grace Paley said. Listen a lot. Look a lot, see what's happening. Yeah?
Had you lived in this part of the country?
Which part?
The part, the background of the book.
I lived in Mexico City for a while, and I did live in the country for a while. That part of Mexico is the whole length of Mexico, you know, practically. is the Central Plateau, and it's like the spine of Mexico and goes all the way down. And there are mines along the length of it. And Ibarra is an imagined name. Ibarra came with Cortez, and he was in charge of finding mines. And he went with his men from one end of Mexico to the other. And I think 20 years, perhaps you'll have to correct me, 20 years, in that period of time, they found every mine in Mexico, all the silver mines. I don't know, well, I may be exaggerating a little, I don't know of any mine that is still operating, that even after a long, long, long space of time when it wasn't being worked, the Spaniards didn't find. And some of them are just have never stopped, like the Valenciana in Guanajuato. They've gone forever. Yeah. Very interesting. I mean, they didn't have the instruments that people have now. And I don't know exactly what their technique was, but they found it and then they sent it back to the kings of Spain. All that silver. Yeah?
Do you keep diaries?
I didn't in Mexico, and it was a terrible crime. I castigate myself for it all the time.
So this was all from memory then?
Yeah, most of it from memory. And people threw away the letters I wrote them. I wish they had. They threw away the letters. Nobody can keep all those letters that friends send you from here and there. And so one friend found the letter when she was moving, and so she sent it to me. And it had three things I'd totally forgotten about. They weren't stories. They were just episodes. But out of each one of those, a story could be made. And I'd forgotten them absolutely, completely. I recommend journals to everybody. End of questions. Oh.
Are you a good letter writer? You mentioned correspondence. Do you correspond with a lot of people?
If you correspond a great deal, it makes a big hole in your writing time. I got some letters, and I answered those letters. I don't know if you call that correspondence.
You mean with friends? Do you have a lot of friends that you correspond with?
Before I became published. Well, not specially. I mean, you know, every now and then I'd write a friend a letter. I didn't do it all the time, no.
I ask because I'm known as letter writer for the world, and I wonder if I'm wasting my talent writing letters to people.
I think you are if you want to do something else, unless those letters people are keeping and you can put them together in a book. I think that's wonderful. If they're such wonderful letters that your friends are keeping them, and suddenly they'll put them together and you put a title on, I think that's a marvelous thing. You may be writing something you don't know. Yeah. But if you're thinking of what you put on the page of a story or trying to write a novel, if you write a good letter, it takes a while. And if you run out of time, which everybody seems to, I don't know if you have time to be prolific in both. Yeah? I don't know which hand I'm looking at.
In the novel, the relationship with Sarah and Richard, how did you know what to tell us and give us and not give us and let us in our own imagination?
I don't think I thought of that. I didn't decide. I think it was the only way I could do it, probably. I probably shouldn't tell you this, but I wrote the book in segments because I kept turning it parts of it into writing class. And only after I'd been doing that for more than a year, someone in the class said, "Why don't you think of making this into a novel because everything's happening in the same place and the same characters are reoccurring?" And that's when I put the Americans in. I'd started with just the Mexican people in the village. I don't think that's a very scientific way to write a novel. I don't think anybody should copy that idea. That's how it just happened. I don't think it's the right way at all. Yeah?
Did you serve as a consultant for the film being made out of?
No. I don't know how to write a script. And I couldn't have done it without going to school for five more years and learn how to write a script. However, yes, I mean, yes, they did call me a consultant and sent me, very kindly sent me the script in all its various phases, and I did have a few suggestions, mostly about facts and occasionally about words, and they were always very kind to me, so I really can't complain about anything. And I must tell you that I like the way it's turning out. So, you know, before you come and see, I didn't know all the wonderful people I was going to meet. I'll have to tell you one thing. They were, this probably be the end because everybody wants to go home, but they were filming on a mountain west of Tucson. I guess it's in the Tucson Mountains, they told me. And we went past a ranch and past some trailer places and so forth. Then we went up a mountain, halfway up a large mountain with very jagged peaks at the top. Beautiful mountain. And all the desert plants were there, all the native plants all around. And the film company had built this house, part of it. They built part of a porch and an angle, nail-shaped thing, with a roof over the porch, and tile, and a roof over the house, so that the roofs came this way, you know, one was higher than the other. And the floors were tile inside and outside the house. It wasn't adobe, naturally, which would take a million years, but it was white plaster. And when I saw that house on that mountain and those desert plants around, I truly thought I'd gone home. And I don't know if any of you have read the book, but in the very first chapter, they get there and they're exhausted at night, and they put up camp cots and sleep in sleeping bags on the porch because they're too worn out to do anything else. And so dawn comes, and these two wonderful actors who are in it, Glenn Close and Keith Carradine, were saying these few words they say when they wake up about the Cincinnati bird. And then suddenly, I was sitting there quietly, you know, not wanting to make a single sound. Suddenly, behind me came this voice with a very slight accent saying, "Good morning, senor. Did you sleep well? There are 12 men waiting at the gate. They want jobs at the mine." And I was that close to bursting into tears. It was terrible, terrible. I thought I was there. This was happening. And so when there was a little space, I turned around and said, "Are you playing the part of Domingo?" And he said, "Yes, he was." So after that, I met everybody. And they said, "I'm Lourdes and I'm Manuela," and all that. And I practically wept, didn't I? Practically. Thanks a lot for coming. Thanks a lot. So, well, we kept everybody over time.
No, you didn't. Can I take your things?